Hello, everyone. It's 8:31. Rabbi Kelman will be coming, but he's not here now. So I'm going to start. The date is October 30th, and this is a new semester, or as it were. Going to speak about one of the great German rabbis, but of course, those who've been with us know that we speak about we have a text, as it were, that we focus on, but we speak about all sorts of things. Let me first say that I met a number of listeners last night at the Tikva conference in Manhattan. That was very nice and a very good experience. So for those of you who were there, either the ones who listen in person or the ones who watch and listen later, it was a pleasure meeting you. And so now, without any further ado, we're going to start with classes on Rav Zalman Ber or Rav Yitzhak Dov Bamberger. Those who know about him, great. We'll try to enlighten you a little more. And if you don't know about him, well, we'll learn about him. As always, the first day of a new, let's say, section, I'm going to hold off. I do have comments and questions from last class, and I want to get to some things about that people sent me, but we'll do that at the end because I want to go right into it. First thing I can say to you is I'm not showing you a picture of him because we don't have a picture. As far as I know, we've never seen a picture. And none of the biographies have a picture about him. He's 1807 to 1878. Certainly could have been a picture of him taken. We have plenty of other pictures of people during that period. So if anyone, especially our experts on German Orthodoxy, know of a picture, but I've been doing this for a long time, never seen a picture. What do we know about the biography, which I'm going to tell you? Well, we have a number of articles discussing it, including one by a descendant. And Leo Jung came out with a number of volumes. One of them was called Jewish Leaders, and he had chapters on great figures, not just rabbis. And we have a chapter there. Fortunately, not so long ago, I don't remember how many years ago exactly, it was 10 years maybe or so. There was collection was put together, two volumes of the collected writings of Rabbi Bamberger, and it has a biographical essay by really the expert on all aspects of German Orthodoxy, Rabbi Hum well, German Orthodoxy, and well, I don't mean German Orthodoxy, although he is a great expert. Certainly, everything to do with Ashkenaz, Minhag Ashkenaz, and well, really, since Professor Breuer has passed away a number of years ago, I assume that Rabbi Hamburger might be regarded as the greatest expert in German Orthodoxy in a historical sense. Obviously, the things he wrote about, he's the expert. We're going to speak about Firth and other things. You ask any pictures? I've never seen any pictures. I looked today again. None of the articles have a picture. No one's ever mentioned a picture. So the family, I mean, we have someone here who knows the family. So please ask the family if they have a picture. All I can say is that as far as I know, a picture was never published. And I'd love to be proven wrong on this. In the essay by Bamberger's descendant, M.L. Bamberger, in the book Jewish Leaders, edited by Leo Jung, he states that Bamberger was perhaps the last outstanding Talmudist raised exclusively in a German Jewish milieu. I mean, we're talking about someone at the highest level. He didn't have to study in Eastern Europe or, just in Germany. So, okay, that's perhaps the case. Although, I don't know, Israel Hildesheimer also was raised in a German milieu. But okay, let me tell you, as always, let's begin with the biography, and then we're going to move into some of the conflicts of his life. We're going to spend at least two classes on the great Ostert controversy, separatism. Can Orthodox Jews be together in a community with non-Orthodox? This really tore the Frankfurt Jewish community apart to a certain extent. And we're going to follow that story until World War II. Actually, we'll follow that story until the present day, because the great dispute between Hirsch and Bamberger remains until this day. And then we'll, of course, go through some of his shaylos and tshuvos, some of his interesting ideas, halachic ideas, other things. Bamberger is from a family. There was three great rabbinic families in Germany. They were known as the ABCs. A is Auerbach. We've spoken about Auerbach before. B is Bamberger. And C is Karlbach. There was a lot of other great rabbis, but those families had a number of rabbis. And Bamberger, although he's the first in the dynasty, his children, many of his sons are rabbis. In fact, we'll see that one of his sons actually is in the Hirshian community. It gets very interesting. Well, someone said you Googled his name and an image. Share the link, please. And we will see the person, Naphtali, who I know is very connected to the family and German Orthodoxy and grew up in the German community. He's listening now. He says, to his knowledge, there are no pictures or portraits. So I'd like to see the picture of the portrait that came up with. If you can, later at the end, I'll look at it, put it in the chat, and I'll look at it at the end. You know, just because the picture says it's his, remember from a few semesters ago, the picture of Charles Salanter, which appears on all the websites, is definitely not Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So send the link, if you will, and we'll get to it at the end. Bamberger was born in 1807 in a village. I don't know anything about this village other than it's the Wiesenbrunn. This was the Avraham Bing. I don't know if you know the name Avraham Bing, who was an important rabbi in Germany. We'll get to him a little bit later on. He wasn't there. He was near there. I don't know anything else about that town. His father was not a great Torah scholar. His father was a businessman. His mother was the Rav of the Rav, was the daughter of a Rav. His name was Hatzfeld, district rabbi in Unterfranken. That's all I can tell you about that is that this was later the position of Avraham Bing. And he attended the local public school. That's in those days, that wasn't uncommon. Now, actually, before I go further, just because I have a great interest in what was just posted, I clicked on what was given to me. And I don't see any pictures on that link that you just sent of all I see is Rabbi Bamberger's tombstone. I don't see a picture. So if anything's in there, you click on it and you can get a more exact, because that's just the Google site or the Bing search. If you actually see a picture there somewhere, click on it and then you give me a more exact reference. But there's definitely nothing there that I just checked. Where did he learn Torah? He studied under the local Rav, which again, this is common. Local rabbis had, little batei midrash or little yeshivas. And then at the age of 15, he went to the yeshiva in Fyrda. Bamberger has three giant volumes. It's amazing how he was able to come up with enough material for three volumes on the yeshiva in Fyrth and all the rabbis who were involved with it there. It's an amazing achievement. And here's something even more amazing. After this, I'm so, blown away. So thanks to one of our listeners, put me in touch with him. We had a nice long conversation, talked about all sorts of things. He's never been to Firth. He wrote a whole book on it. I asked him, didn't you have an interest? You're writing about all these things, all the pictures. He's from Switzerland. He didn't go there. So that I couldn't do. Privately, someone texts me that the picture is not of Rav Zeldman Ber Bamberger. It's Rav Zeldman Ber from the Avodas Yisrael Siddur, classic Siddur, published in Eastern Europe, called the Avodas Yisrael Siddur with commentary. So that's a different Zeldman Ber, not Zeldman Ber. His last name is actually Ber, as opposed to the one we're speaking about. It's Zeldman Ber Bamberger. At the time, the great yeshiva in Fürth was led by Rav Wolf Hamburger, the Gedolei Yisrael in Germany. Author of his most famous work is Nachas Binyamin, also Shar Zakenin. We know that Bamberger stayed at the yeshiva for 5 years until he's 20. He received a smicha, and he returned home, and he doesn't become a rav. He doesn't want to become a rav. I don't know what to make about it. Often you see the biographies of these certain rabbis who don't become practicing rabbis. They go into business or something, and they always say about them, as words of praise. he didn't want to make the Torah a spade, you know, kardam lach barba, you know, like that. He didn't want to use the Torah for his personal benefit. And it's always said as some great praise. But then what's the flip side of that? Isn't the flip side of that? It's sort of like an underhanded negative comment about all the other rabbis who did go into the Rabbanus. You know, if there's a problem going to the Rabbanus, then what about the others? But Rabbi Bamberger is one of those who didn't go into the rabbinate. He opened up a small shop. He later married the daughter of the Rav of Fulda. His name was Rav Zekel Wurmser. These are important names in the German Orthodox tradition, not so important when you leave it, although Rav Bamberger will be important. We know that although he was not a Rav, young people sought him out to study with him. And it's during this time that he wrote a book devoted to the laws of Chalitza. When a woman's husband dies and she doesn't have any children, and the husband has a brother, then according to the Torah, you have to do Yibum, the levirate marriage, or Chalitza. The Ashkenazic tradition is we do the ceremony of Chalitza. And where, you know, she takes off a shoe, she spits in and says, you know, the whole ceremony there. In the Torah, the Chalitza is sort of like a bad thing. It's like you should do Yibum, you don't do Yibum, so it's like second best. But already in medieval times, the rabbis understood that today people, they're not at the high level, really, to do it for the mitzvah. They would see it as sexual immorality, all the reasons that have been given. And therefore, the Ashkenazim, unlike the Sfaradim, the Ashkenazim, Chalitza became actually obligatory. You had to get special rabbinic permission if you wanted to do Yibum. So he writes a book on Chalitza. He didn't publish it until almost 30 years later, and it became an important work. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank actually said that anytime he would do a Chalitza, because it would come up, Tzvi Pesach Frank was the Rav of Jerusalem, head of the Beis Din. So occasionally Chalitza would come up. Every time he would have to do Chalitza, he would review the halachas from that book. Because again, it's not something that is so common, so you'd have to review it. Now, I said before he received a smicha. This is what, I think that's what Bamberger says, that he received a smicha. As I recall, Hamburger does not say that. As I recall, I have to check it again, because we know that he, when he was 30, in 1837, Rav Avraham Bing sent him a smicha without him asking for it. So maybe he did have a, I can't remember if Hamburger mentions getting an earlier smicha, but whatever it is, Avraham Bing, who's the district rabbi of Würzburg. At this time, Avraham Bing is in rabbi in Würzburg and of the district, not just, we're talking about like, I think it's 29 towns. He's the Rav of, he sends Rabbi Bamberger a smicha, and he tells everyone that now you can ask him shailas, and if I'm not around, or if you know it's too difficult to get to me, I can't paskin for you, you go to Bamberger. He can paskin for you. It makes sense, therefore, that when Rabbi Bing retires in 1838, that Rabbi Bamberger is elected to succeed him. And again, the position in Würzburg is not a little position. Sometimes the rabbis are just in the city. Other times they're in all the local communities. You take a place like Würzburg, because they said 29 communities in surrounding towns and villages. You have the city, obviously, and then you have small towns. Jews in Germany lived in small towns. Hermann Schwab wrote a whole book, a little book, but a book on Jewish rural communities. You had Jews living in small towns, Jews who were farmers. And we don't usually think of this, and small towns, barely enough to make a minyan. But you had Jews living in little towns like this. Obviously, they didn't have a rabbi. It's too small. Usually they'd have, or often they'd have someone who doubled as a chazan and a shochet, and sometimes there was just the local people had to do it. So who's in charge? Who's going to be the rabbinic leader? So you had the Rav, let's say in the city, and then in the surrounding towns, he was also their Rav. So he was in charge of them. Maybe occasionally go spend Shabbos there with him. I don't know, but he would go visit the towns, and that's how it worked in Germany. It's in, as far as I know, in Poland you didn't have a situation like this, or in Lithuania where you had a rabbi and you had little towns in the area. As far as I know, all these little towns had their own rabbi, and sometimes the rabbi would also have a job in addition. But you had this situation in Germany. You had in Spain. Spain also. Spain, you had Jews in lots of little towns. No rabbis. And some of these towns didn't even have enough people for a minyan. They'd have to come to the big city on the holidays. So he becomes Rav. Now, if you look at the Wikipedia entry, which I did this morning on Rav Bing, it lists Rav Bamberger as one of his students. What I have to say about that is, and this was sometimes Wikipedia entries on Jewish figures are just lifted from the Jewish Encyclopedia, or
That's
maybe
what
even Encyclopedia Judaica. This, I checked the Jewish Encyclopedia. There's a lot more information, so someone added this. I have to say that this is sort of true, but not exactly. Yes, Bamberger refers to him as Mori V'Rabbi, which means my teacher. On the other hand, when we think of teacher, we think of someone who studied in a yeshiva with him. He never studied. Bamberger never studied in Rav Bing's yeshiva. However, when he was living in the town he's born in, Wiesenbrunn, which is in the district of Würzburg, we know that he saw himself under Rav Bing's authority, and he would often go to him and talk and learning, to use the Lithuanian expression, ask him questions. So I guess that makes him his teacher, but not in the sense, not in the formal sense of studying in his yeshiva. Now he's elected. I said that Rabbi Bamberger is elected Rav of Würzburg. There was no guarantee this would happen. We know that there was a strong reform contingent at this time in Würzburg, and they made much of the fact, although many of these reformers or modernizers, you can call them, maybe they're not actually reformers, although they were reformers, but even some who are not reformers, we can call them modernizers. They made much of the fact that Bamberger has no secular education. You know that in Germany, within a few years of Bamberger's election, in any decent position, any city, not in the small towns, but in any real significant position, they wanted a rabbi with a secular education, one who could speak fluent German, Hochdeutsch, one who preferably had a doctorate. We have some exceptions, but certainly a secular education, because how can you have a rabbi if the people are all being secular educated and are going to university? You need a rabbi as well. So that was going to be a problem for him. I mean, he had a basic secular education, but he didn't go to university. He didn't have an advanced secular education. In fact, the reformers wrote to the government stating that he should not be allowed to take up the position precisely because he doesn't have enough of a secular education. Let's not forget also, Würzburg was a university town. And the Orthodox also wanted a rabbi with a secular education. Look, if the Jews are being given complete rights in the town, it's important, they thought, that the representative of the Jews would have a secular education so he can make a good appearance for them. But in the end, the Orthodox were convinced. They supported Bamberger, and he was elected. But he knew, Bamberger himself realized after this, that he cannot serve as the rabbi the way he is, that he needs a good secular education. So when you're dealing with geniuses like Bamberger, they don't need to go to the university. They can be autodidacts. They can learn it on their own. Bamberger realized that German Jewry has entered a new era. You know, they're leaving the ghetto, emancipation, and he needs to be a leader who's together with them as they face this new world. So what does he do? He learns Greek and Latin. What does he need Greek and Latin for? Because university-educated people knew Greek and Latin. So you don't want a situation where the Baal HaBos, who had a university or had a good high school education, gymnasium, knew Greek and Latin. So he learned Greek and Latin. He learned other areas of secular studies. He learned proper German. Until that time, he didn't speak Hochdeutsch. He spoke, I don't want to call it Yiddish, Judeo-Deutsch, I guess a dialect of sorts, he learned to speak pure German. Look, he's going to meet with the government officials and everything. So I don't think anyone would have any issues with Bamberger after a few years. He also opens up the yeshiva at Würzburg that had been closed at the end of Rabin's life. This, however, was an old-fashioned yeshiva. no secular studies. Very different than what Hirsch is going to do and what Hildesheimer is going to do. And wait till you hear what Bamberger has to say about Hildesheimer's yeshiva. Hey. In 1855, he opens up an elementary Jewish school where children are taught Torah and secular studies. I can't recall now. I should have checked before, and I'm not going to do it now, what year Hirsch opened up his school. But this is one of the first day schools, boys and girls separate. Until then, what was the procedure? Boys and girls went to the local public schools and were taught Torah after coming home from school. That was the way things were done. Let me read you what Hamburger mentions on page 526. I think I saw it here that he says that they were separate schools for boys and girls. Let me see quickly. I mean, obviously there was an assimilation and you have to give the kids a Jewish education. The idea that you're just going to send them to a, okay, so to a Talmud Torah of sorts wasn't good enough. Okay, so he created a machina, I guess, to get people up to par, and three classes with the focus, he tells us, on Limudei Kodesh. Half the day was Limudei Kodesh. Oh, yeah, separate schools for boys and girls. Now, here you have something which you don't have in Hirsch's school and Hildesheimer. For the girls' school, instead of Tanakh and Mishnah, which was learned by the boys, they learned Melechet Yad. Melechet Yad is, I guess, home economics. How to sew, how to cook, all those things. Hey, when I went to JAC, the girls' school, Bruria, this is in the 80s, still had classes in sewing and cooking. And you know something? I never thought it was a problem. I thought that they should teach us to sew and to cook. Half of us are going to be living single who knows how many years. But that never would have gone over well. Why do I say it's so different? Because take a look at the essay I published in the Tradition a few issues ago from Israel Hildesheimer and the model school he had. And he talks about the importance of teaching girls Hebrew and Tanakh and Hebrew, you know, all of Chumash in depth. No Gemara, nor Torah Shabbat Peh, but still it's a serious Jewish education. And Hirsch also, not so much, maybe, you know, in Würzburg, a little bit out of the way. I don't know when that changed. It would have had to change. What else did they teach the students, both boys and girls? Well, English was an optional language. I think that's significant. Mid-19th century to be teaching English. French was obligatory. I'm a little surprised English. And now, of course, you go today to like these North African countries, you know, French, they still do the French, you know, Tunisia, Morocco, they still do the French curriculum. And everyone knows it's crazy. And they're starting to institute now English because French is really not important like it used to be. And then it says when the school opened, it had 80 students. Within 20 years, by 1877, it was 170, and with increasing the classes. So a big success. Sometimes people don't realize that in Germany, there were Jewish day schools. Just like in America, we had it, but they had it in Germany. Really Jewish day schools with Torah and secular studies. Okay, so that's Würzburg. But he's the communal rabbi of 29 different communities. How are you going to bring Torah to children who are living in the small towns in his district? Yes, they went to the public school, and if they could, they had a melamed, reverend, cantor, maybe a shochet who lived in town who would teach them. But as we know, often these teachers were not well trained. They didn't know anything, and they couldn't make a living doing anything else, so they started doing that. So that's a problem. Now, even for very religious people, and you still had, although in the big cities, by the mid-19th century, the non-Orthodox dominated. It's amazing. It happened in two generations. In the small towns, you still had many small towns, even in Germany, in which traditional Judaism continued. You had one shul, and that shul was an Orthodox shul. You still had very pious people in the small towns. And Stanley Drachman, in his memoir, speaks about going back to Germany and going. His family came from one of these small towns. Well, the law was that secular education was required from ages 6 to 12. So you had to go to the public school. In fact, the public schools also met on Saturdays. So you have W. C. Hoffman has a question, has a tshuva about this, and others. What are the Jews supposed to do? You can't tell them not to go to school on Saturday. It's one day a week. So W. C. Hoffman says, well, you can go, you can't write. And then there's the issue, well, can you have like davening for the kids later in the day? That sort of thing. That was the reality, where in a situation where Saturday was not recognized as an official day off. Furthermore, it became more complicated because not only did you have to have a secular education, in 1859, the government required that religious teachers would not be recognized by the government without attaining a certain level of secular studies and formal training. You had to be recognized by the government, unless you were completely independent, but you had often religious teachers. Sometimes there'd be an hour where they taught religion, and you have a Catholic, the priest would come in and teach, and the Protestant and the Jewish person would come in and teach. And so you had to be recognized. And how'd you have to be recognized? What'd you have to do? Well, you had to, as I said, have secular studies, formal training and education. Well, Bamberger was a builder. What does he do? He opens up a teacher seminary in 1864 that exists until the end of German Jewry. I can't find the exact time it closed, either 1938 or 1939. Many of these institutions closed at Kristallnacht, but some were open a little bit later. So look how long this went on. During his lifetime, around 30 students were in the seminary at any one time. Teachers from the school were hired by towns all over Germany to provide Jewish education. So you come out of that, and then a town. Town can't afford a rabbi, let's say, or even if they have a rabbi, but they need a teacher. So you'd be trained there, you'd go and you'd teach, you'd learn. I don't know if, actually, now I'm thinking about this, I gotta check. I'm not sure if women were trained in the early years, not. By the end, yes. But I think at the beginning it was just men. He wanted to open a yeshiva that would also include basic secular education. This is going to be different than Hildesheimer, but he died before this could be brought to fruition. Okay, so the basic biography of Bamberger. By the way, Würzburg was a university town. I mentioned it. So you had many young men coming to study at the university, who also wanted to study at the yeshiva. So they studied his yeshiva. What do we had a yeshiva? I told you he opened a yeshiva. What he never ended up opening was a yeshiva that would also include secular studies. For him, the yeshiva, and when I say to him, the classic yeshiva should remain the way it was, the way it always was, Torah only, no secular studies. Yes, he agreed that to open up a separate sort of yeshiva branch for people who needed basic secular education, but that doesn't take away from the fact, like the Netziv, you have to have the yeshiva. Torah only, they want to do some secular studies. In the end, he ended up teaching a little secular studies in the yeshiva, but it didn't alter the actual framework of the yeshiva. He was opposed, therefore, to the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. In Berlin, Rav Israel Hildesheimer opened up the seminary where he was training them, first of all, obviously in Halacha and Gemara, but also in advanced levels of Jewish history, Tanakh, things like that. And everyone was expected to also have a have an advanced secular degree. University education, and they advocated Wissenschaftliches Judentum, academic study. To give you an example of how opposed Bamberger was, I want to read to you what Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer says. Here's the collected letters of Israel Hildesheimer. If you look in the Hebrew section, page 50, he says that he knows for a fact, B'li shum pikuk shel ha'olam. He knows this. He knows it. That what did Bamberger say to one of his colleagues? That my hatred, the seminar, to the that's what it is with the Zion. The seminar shel Hildesheimer, he yoter gedolah mil seminar shel Geiger. So according to Israel Hildesheimer, Bamberger said that his opposition to the Hildesheimer Seminary is stronger than his opposition to Geiger. Shocking stuff. But if I can explain it, I think what he means is that, you know, everyone knows that Geiger Seminary is treif, it's pusul. It can't affect us. We have our own Orthodox communities. So, you know, what do I need to be concerned about that? However, Hildesheimer Seminary, that can change Orthodoxy in a bad way. And therefore, his hatred for it is more than his hatred for Hildesheimer Seminary, for Geiger Seminary. I hope it's not true. But Hildesheimer says he knows absolutely that that's what Bamberger said. So there. His first published book, Bamberger, was it's called Melech HaShemayim. It deals with the laws of Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah. Okay. His next book was called Amira Leveis Yaakov. It deals with, I guess you can call it the women's laws. A number of books like this written in the vernacular. In America, you had a number of books like this. So there was a Rabbi Hershowitz, Abram Hershowitz. He's well known, for those who know, because he was in Australia. And he sent a letter to the rabbis in Europe asking the same Talmud bracha, the same bracha, should they switch it? The same question I was also asked for in South America. But before he went there, he was in America and in New York. And he published a book in Yiddish, also one of these books directed towards women. And we have a number of them, always in the vernacular, in Yiddish, or here Judeo-German, in Hebrew, German, in Hebrew script, because even the women read the Hebrew script. It deals with Nida, various halachot, lighting candles, things like that. It appeared in many, many editions and also later in German script. He also wrote a book called Morel Azovchi, which is Laws of Shlita. You know, every town, you know, you need to be shechting. So a lot of people need to know the laws of Shlita. It's not like us where we just go buy it in the supermarket. In the last book he wrote, we'll get to the Tshuvos and everything. The Tshuvos were published, we'll get to that as well. He didn't publish that. But the last book in his lifetime was published in two parts. It's called Korei Be'emet, Korei Be'emes. And it deals with the phenomenon of Al Tikrei. We usually say Al Tikrei, but it's really a Seiri under Al Tikrei. We have in the Gemara and Midrash where it says, don't read it like this, read it like this. So what is that about? And his point in this book, and he goes through all the different examples, is that these are only midrashic statements. The rabbis were not saying that the text is corrupt and in need of correction. I want to read to you here. If you look in the introduction, he takes on Rav Elijah Bachor, also known as Elijah Levita. Elijah Levita is a famous grammarian, and he wrote the work, the Tishbi, the Sefer Tishbi, which is all about the Hebrew words, and he was a great grammarian. And if you go to Venice, you can go in the cemetery on Lido Island, and you will see the tombstone of Eliyahu Levita. He was also called Eliyahu Bachor. He was married, though, but I guess early in his life, they called him Bachor, and that just stuck with him. He's not actually buried underneath there. We don't know where he's buried. A couple hundred years ago, they took all the tombstones. They got rid of them because they wanted to use as a park, and they threw them all in the water. And when in the 20th century or the late 19th century, they brought all the tombstones out. Well, now they have tombstones, so we know who's buried there. We don't know where he's buried. So they just put the tombstones there, including Yehuda Leon Modna. This is what he says in the introduction. He says that the medakdek, he calls him a medakdek, which he is, a medakdek. You know, that's sort of like a put down, though, because he's a medakdek. He's a grammarian. He's not a great rabbi. He's a medakdek. Revoa Bachor, he wrote a book called Masoras HaMasoras. And there he deals with grammatical issues, nekudot, all these things. And he said, what does he say in this book? He says that when the Gemara, the Midrash, says Al Tikre, it's because people were reading it incorrectly. Remember, they didn't have written down the nekudos. So therefore, you see a word and you're pronouncing it improperly. Look, today, even when it's written down, people pronounce the words improperly. Sometimes even in shul, when it has the nekudos, people pronounce it improperly. And if it doesn't have nekudos, so can you imagine all the things we're pronouncing, mispronouncing all the time? I've corrected in the past many, many times. Sometimes I make mistakes. So Levita, Eliyahu Bachor's position was that these are psukim. People read it one way, so they said, no, don't read it that way, read it this way. And Rabbi Bamberger says that if you understand who the sages were, this is impossible. And what he says is, Devari Meshubashim, this is absolutely incorrect. And he says, you know, that, he's already been rejected by Rav. One of the other authorities he mentions, and one of the examples he gives to show, first of all, if that was the case, what Eliyahu Bachor says, then that it was because of the Safek, since Bachor tells us that the Nekudos come from the Tiberians, Anshei Tveria, he says, Im kein, hayu chachamim chukamim yoser michachmei Talmud. Then you're telling me, Eliyahu Bachor, that the Tiberian sages, the Masoretes, were greater than the Chachmei HaTalmud. V'zeh lo amin. I can't believe that. Because in other words, the sages, the Talmud, people are misreading these words all over the place that they have to do Al Tikre. They don't make the Nekudos. Rather, it comes to the Masoretes. They come up with this great idea. So that means that the Masoretes are better than the sages because they're smarter. They realize they come up with a way to stop all these problems, all these mistakes. You know, Eliyahu Bachor, he argues at length that the Nekudos originate with the Masoretes. And it is true. If you look in the Talmud, there's no reference to it, no mention of this and of the Nekudos. The problem is, at least for some, that the Zohar mentions the Nekudos. So the Zohar knows the Nekudos. So either you'll say, well, this is obviously a proof that the Zohar is medieval, because if the Nekudos were only invented by the Masoretes, then that's a great proof. And that's, of course, cited by everyone. Or you could say that, no, they had the Nekudos. Why aren't they mentioned? You know, the Zohar, I mean, it's not just a tradition of reading, the actual Nekudos. You know, there's different types of Nekudos also. There's on the top and on the bottom. And in Tiberias, they did it one way. In Babylonia, they did it another way. So that's sort of an argument against the antiquity of the Zohar, where if you want to be honest, I think you have to say, if you want to uphold the antiquity of the Zohar, you have to say, well, that's an interpolation. We know there are many interpolations in the Zohar. The Chasam Sofer, who believed the Zohar was Tana Idik, he said that if you actually took the authentic elements of the Zohar versus the interpolations, it would be a very small book. I mean, the Zohar mentions sages, Amoraic sages. It mentions events that happened way after Rashbi. So I think you'd be forced to say that it's a later interpolation. So there's obviously a reading tradition. There's mistakes in the reading tradition. According to Eliyahu Bachor, Al Tikre is an example of corrections of this. And Bamberger rejects this entirely. As far as Bamberger is concerned, all the Al Tikres are simply Midrashic derivations. It's not telling you, it's Midrashic. It's another way of reading. It's, you know, remember, there's no Nekudot. So when it says Al Tikre this, rather read it this way, we don't have Nekudot. So Bachor is assuming Al Tikre the mistaken way, and here's the correct way. For Bamberger, no, it's Al Tikre the correct way. Rather, read it this way, but not, it's Midrashic. It's not telling you to change the reading. It's just Midrashic. And then Bamberger cites an amazing proof, which I don't know how Eliyahu Levita could refute this. We have examples where it's Al Tikre about letters. So, for example, Al Tikre Mehoncha. Mehoncha. I mean, we have examples where they do an Al Tikre with the letters. Certainly, in these cases, they're not saying that your Tanakh is mistaken. You correct it instead of the hey parochet. All it's saying is that it's giving like a midrashic interpretation. You can read it this way and get a nice lesson. I guess Levita would have to say those examples are midrashic. But once if those examples are midrashic, Bamberger's point is, then everything is midrashic. So a very interesting. If any of you are interested in the whole phenomenon of Tikre, you have to go to his work. Now, you can find it on Otzer HaChachma. In his, they reprinted it in a book called Rav Yitzchak Dov HaLevi Bamberger. Now, during his lifetime, the two greatest poskim and Talmudists in Germany were Yaakov Ettlinger and Rabbi Bamberger. Here's a picture of where is it? I have here. Here's of Yaakov Ettlinger. I don't know why Bamberger is regarded by his descendants as the last great Talmudist. He's the same time as Ettlinger. Ettlinger is completely a German trained. Ettlinger is the author of the Aruch HaNer, famous commentary on Talmud, on Bikurei Yaakov, on Sukkah, issues of Sukkahs, and the Binyan Sion, his famous tshuva. So these are two great rabbis of the old school, not university educated, although he went 1 year to university and then he left. There was it was called the Hep-Hep riots, where the Jews, terrible anti-Semitism, sort of like what we're having today, actually. And he was forced to leave, or he left. I think it's like Judaica says he was forced to leave. Maybe it was violence, or he just felt there wasn't a place for him. Incidentally, TABC in Bergen County sent out an email yesterday, I think. It was sent to me today, in which to all the parents saying that they're, when they have a college night, every college that wants to come to present at TABC, and I bet you this is going to be followed by others, has to show the school what they're doing to keep Jewish students safe, what they're doing in response to anti-Semitism, and if not, they will not be welcome at the college night of TABC. So I think that's a good step, but I don't know what you know. What are the universities going to say? We're going to do this and that and that. You know, there's a limit to what the university can do when you have crazy genocidal students and professors. But still, at least they could make statements. And hopefully, we will not have Hep-Hep riots. But I have to say, if you saw what happened in Tulane. If you saw, we're this close in some places, so just the Mirtzah Hashem, it won't spill over into that. So both of them, Ettlinger and Rabbi Bamberger, were the leading halachic authorities. Ettlinger dies in 1871, and until 1878, Bamberger is unquestionably the preeminent halachic authority. By the way, Yaakov Ettlinger says something so strange, I can't understand it. He wonders whether we can use esrogim that come from the southern hemisphere, because he says they're growing the wrong way. It's a very strange passage, which everyone is, a lot of people have pointed to this, because it doesn't really make sense. If anyone knows, I just bring this up not to get into it, but if anyone knows about this and you know an answer for this, you know what? The Southern Hemisphere doesn't grow differently. It's very, very strange. But we did classes on Yaakov Ettlinger, and you can see them on the Torah Motion website. Now, what I just mentioned about Ettlinger and Bamberger, the preeminent halakhic authority, this is going to have great relevance to the internal, inner German dispute that we will discuss. Because just to anticipate, you know, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, great rabbi, but there's no question that Bamberger is the posek ador in Germany, the greatest posek. So really, why does Hirsch think that he can argue with Bamberger on what Hirsch himself says is a halachic matter? So we will see what Hirsch says, and he actually makes a very good point, because just because you're the greatest Talmudist, if you don't understand the Metzius, well, if you don't understand the reality, well, then you know, you don't it doesn't who, your psak might not be worth anything. So it's a very bitter dispute between the two of them, and we will get to that. In addition to the Sfarim that I mentioned, Bamberger is also as a great posek. Of course, he's a great respondent, a meshiv. He wrote many responsa. And yet he didn't publish his responsa. Why didn't he publish them? He let his children know he did not want to shoulder the responsibility. Yes, he answered a question, but to publish it, to put it in print, that is not for this specific case. That is Lidoros. That is for forever in all countries. Look, in his town or in his community in Germany, if someone asks him, he gives an answer. But to put it in print means that he's saying that this is something that everyone can rely on. This is my psak, and he didn't want to share that responsibility. So then his sons had a question. He has all these manuscripts at Shuvos. He made it clear to them he didn't want them to be published. Do the sons need to follow their father's wishes and bury the Shuvos, like bury them in his grave or just destroy them? Or can they print the Shuvos? We know that you're supposed to fulfill Divrei HaMeis. Someone who dies, you're supposed to fulfill his wish. And it's your father. If he tells you something, you're supposed to follow it. And these are tzaddikim, great rabbis who were his sons. They'll do anything for their father. But the question is, even this, his father's whole life was spent teaching Torah, and he answered many shilas. He doesn't want to publish the tshuvot because he's modest. He doesn't think he's worthy of it. But they, as his children, know that he's worthy of it. And all the other rabbanim realize this. Do they need to listen to their father? So who can they ask this? This is a question you have to ask the Gadol Yisrael. There's no one in Germany you can ask for this. Who can ask? Hildesheimer? We already saw what he thought about Hildesheimer's seminary. You can ask Hirsch? You can't ask Hirsch. Wait till you see the dispute between them. You need to ask who are the great ones? Well, they ask a few rabbis. I don't know why they asked a few. Maybe because they were looking for the answer they wanted. But they asked the Netziv. And, well, we'll go through. So we have record of three, although I think it might only be two. So who do they ask first? One of the sons asked the Netziv. The first one look at the Netziv. Because we have the Netziv has a tshuva to one of Rabbi Bamberger's sons explaining why, despite what your father said, you can ignore it and publish it. I mean, this issue of, publishing writings of the Gadol Yisrael, it's always been of interest to me, because when I published some of the writings of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, people said you had no right, you shouldn't have published it. And I consulted with someone well-known, and he said, we don't censor Gadol Yisrael. And later I saw that, the Netziv says, that we're supposed to publish the writings of great Torah sages, even if they didn't want it. So but let me tell you what the Netziv said, because it is fascinating. And you can find it in the Tshuvos, the Meshiv Davar, volume 1, number 24. But the Netziv touched up that letter a bit in the Meshiv Davar. If you want to see the original one, you can see it Igros on the Tziv Mivolozhin, which comes from the actual manuscript. And it's a slightly different in certain ways, but the same basic idea, the same conclusion, but a little different. So it's a letter written to the son, Moshe Aryeh Bamberger. Let me just call your attention to the things that caught my eye. It's a fairly long letter. Actually not that long. And what was the issue that the father raised, Rabbi Bamberger? First, he begins by saying, Rabbi Bamberger didn't want to publish his tshuvos because he says, you shouldn't rely on me. Why? He says that English smocha ha-tshuva, that when a rabbi writes a responsum, it's at the moment. He gets a letter. He sits down that night. He writes the responsum. He sends it off. He says that doesn't have the same level as if you write a commentary. Like he wrote commentaries. He wrote halachic works. He published his halachic works. He didn't want to publish his tshuva because he thought that when he published a volume of halacha, let's say on Sefer Torah, he had all the time in the world. He looked up sources. He was settled. And therefore, he said that this is just the works, his halachic writings on Sefer Torah, Mezuzah, those sorts of things, that's the Dorot forever. And his tshuva is just for this time, and he didn't have time really to investigate it in detail or things like that. And then it's and Rabbi Bamberger wrote a proof for this because you have poskim. Let's say we have the Rush, Rav Asher ben Yechiel, and he wrote what's called psakim. If you look in the back of the Gemaras, you have the Rush, and he tells you the halacha. The Rush also wrote many tshuva, many responsa. Sometimes they contradict. Well, who do you go by? Who do you follow? If the Rosh contradicts himself in the tshuva of Tzitzakim, which is his answer? Which can you rely on? And we know that there are some that said we rely on the Psakim. That's what's in the back of the Gemara. Because you're not supposed to. Rabbi Bamberger says that when he wrote a tshuva, the Rosh, again, it was for this specific case. You know, he didn't have peace of mind. So there are for two reasons. He offers that, he didn't want anyone to rely on him, and the tshuva itself was not at the same high level. And what does the Netziv say? Absolutely incorrect. This is not right. The Netziv says, on the contrary, when you write a responsum, when it's halacha lemaisa, when you're actually answering a question for someone, as opposed to just putting it in a book, your ideas, you will get you actually arrive at a better understanding of it. And what about the fact that some poskim, not all poskim, but some poskim say that when the Rosh contradicts himself, you go by the psakim, you don't go by the tshuvos? He says the meaning of this is that it's because the psakim were later. His tshuvot are earlier. I'm not sure how he knows that, but he says Mistama, that his son who says that who says that we follow his Rav Yehuda ben Arash. Rav Yehuda, the son of the Rush, becomes Rav in Toledo after his father dies. He also says that you follow Psakim. So the Netziv says this is Mistama yada b'no d'psakav hayim l'charim. He knew that he wrote the psakim later, and the father, the Rush, retracted. I don't know how he knows that. I mean, I guess there might be times in the psakim where he mentions what I wrote in the tshuvot, but the tshuvot he was writing his whole life. So how can you know that? But that's what he says, and he says that's the case. If you know that he retracted his psakim, that you should follow the tshuva. But in general, you follow the tshuvot. And then he goes on to say, on page 191, he says that it's true there are other great rabbis who didn't want to publish their tshuvos. Rav Herzog's father-in-law, Rabbi Hilmit, Shmuel Yitzhak Hilmit of London, of Glasgow, and then later on the Basin of London. I'm very interested in this tshuvot because I'm actually in violation, maybe, because he wrote his tshuva, but he didn't want to publish it, they say, and I've published about eight or nine of the tshuvas now, because his notebook remains. And he said, when he died, he said that it should be burnt, or buried with him, I believe. And Rav Herzog, his son-in-law, didn't agree, didn't listen, and they never published it, though, but he refused to destroy it. And it's in the Israel State Archives, and there's an annual called HaMashbir, that comes out in, let me show you what one looks like. It comes out in Flatbush. So here's what it looks like, HaMashbir. It's dedicated to Rav Avadya Yosef's life. I mean, dedicated to Rav Avadya Yosef. So there's always articles about Rav Avadya. So, hey, look at this right at the beginning. I don't know if you can see it well. First article from Rav Avadya, second from Rav Avadya, and look who's the third. None other than Rav Melech Shapiro, Mikhtavim min Archeon. So that's me. And whose authors am I publishing? Mostly, not only, but mostly in every issue, Rav Shmuel Yitzhak Hillman, who wrote a sefer, the Or HaYashar, a great sefer on Shas and Yerushalmi. But he didn't want this to be published. But based on the Netziv, I feel it's okay to publish it. And no one's complained. I mean, he was the greatest posek in England in his day before Rav Yecheskel Abramsky. So what does what the Netziv says? He says, yes, it's true that there was great gedolim who didn't publish their tshuvot. He says that They did. It's because Yisroel Judah was beyond. He says that he thought that they would give too much weight on it. Therefore, they didn't want people to rely on them. On the contrary, though, they said they when the when their halachos that they wrote, they psukim, they weren't concerned that they would rely on them so much. You know, I think I misremembered here that. You know what? I was wrong what I said. It's not that I was misremembering. I was remembering with the other gedolim. The other gedolim said, "Don't publish the tshuvos," because they didn't want to take the responsibility. People rely on them. Rabbi Bamberger, he obviously didn't want people to rely on it, but he gave a separate reason. The reason I mentioned that because when you're writing tshuvos, you're not focused so much. So the Nitziv says. Those people who didn't want it because they didn't want people to rely on it. That's a separate reason. If you don't feel you're such a great posek, you don't want people to rely on it, but that's not what Rabbi Bamberger said. He argued more Talmudically. And then Nitziv says, leaving this aside, whatever the reason Rabbi Bamberger said, after all, he said, don't publish it. So the Nitziv says, we have to investigate. Does the posek who publishes the tshuva, who writes the tshuva, does he have the koach, the strength, say that you can't learn what I wrote? In other words, I wrote a tshuva, I sent it to them, but no one else is allowed to study this Torah. In other words, does the Torah belong to me? So when we get back next week, we're going to see the Nitziv, and then we're going to see Rav Yitzchak Hanan. And the question is, if I write Torah, I give a psak, do I own this? If I own this, then I could say, well, it's mine. I wrote it. I own it. It's my Torah. Therefore, if I say you can't publish it, you have no right to publish it, and no one has a right to read it. Or is the case going to be like, well, the tshuvos were published, so you already know what the Nitziv and the Rav Yitzchak Hanan says. But why they said it? Where did they get the idea? After that, you could tell you could say Rabbi Bamberger says, don't publish it, and we say we don't listen to you. So we'll see what the great Nitziv has to say, and also Rav Yitzchak Hanan. These are the two greatest, really, authorities, I think, at that time in the Lithuanian world. We'll see what they say next class. I now, before I get to the questions, I should have stopped earlier. I see. We'll get to some next class then. I want to just deal with briefly for 3 minutes, and then I'll get to some of the questions about Talis. Because Rav Nachum Shemaryahu, I asked about what's this with Tacheles on the Talis. We all have black Sfardim; they have just a white Talis. And I said, I've never seen anyone with blue. I said that the Mishnah Brura mentions blue. I thought. I said I thought. I and he does. I looked it up. Here's the Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Hayim Tes 9. It's the Rama says that we only make white tzitzis, even for colored garments. Okay, so our tzitzis are white. What does the Mishnah Berurah say? This is also on Sifkaton Tes Zayin. The Mishnah Berurah says, regarding what we find that the edge of the garment is like the color of Techeles on our talises, this is not an issue because the main part of the garment is, we go by the main part is white. So the Shulchan Aruch said, you're not supposed to have different colors, but so if the tzitzis are white, the talis is supposed to be white. It's not a problem because it's not the main part. But here we have the Chafetz Chaim, right in the end of the 19th century, and he's mentioning techeles on talis. Can you go into any litvish shul? You won't find anyone with blue. So Nachum Shmaryahu writes to me that this used to be, blue used to be quite common in Galicia. And a number of Hasidic rebbes wore it, and he says bells today they are. So lo and behold, I look it up, and bells has blue, although it's very, very dark blue, and it looks sort of like black. The Rambam in Hilchos Tzitzis says that Techeles is very close to black. But now, maybe one of you can help me on this. I looked up. The commentaries, and if you look in the Prima Gaudium in the Eish Shel Avraham in Sif Tes Sif Katan Vav, He speaks also about, listen, he speaks, the Mishnah Berurah mentions, yeah, Mishnah Berurah just, yeah, what does it mean? He says, Sfas HaBeged, the edge of the garment. And this is the same lashon we see in other sources. What do you mean by the edge of the garment? Our talluses are not on the edge of the garment. I mean, our stripes, they're in the middle. Here's even a picture. I found a picture online. This is a painting from 1884. Look at this. It's in blue. So this would appear to be evidence that very East European looking rabbinic type Jews, they were, I shouldn't say rabbinic type, they all get rabbis, but all the people look like rabbis. Look at that. They're wearing butalesim. But why the edge? And our talluses, it's in the middle. It's everywhere. It's actually not on the edge. If you look in the Prima Gotti, we're going back now to the 18th century, and he takes it back even 100 years before, because he's quoting, actually, no, this is quoting, he's not quoting Eliyahu Rabbah. He says that the edge, Sasa Begek, ain't, so he's mentioned that they had blue. What is he, why do I say it's strange? Because earlier he says, he says that what's the color of the talus, the tchelis? He says talis yarok, hanikra blah, b'lshon Ashkenaz zecher tchelis. What do you mean talis yarok? Green? I thought maybe green. Maybe they used to regard green as green meant blue. Maybe I thought. I don't know. I looked up Eliezer ben Yehuda's dictionary, and no, it's all he says is yarok is green. So how is it that what does the Prima Gotti mean when he says green? Anyone, any answers to this? Actually, I think he's quoting Eliyahu Rabbah. He's quoting Eliyahu Rabbah here. So that's even earlier. So he called it, it was blue, but he called it green. He saw blue as green. I mean, I don't know. This is a big issue, by the way. No one sees colors exact same. There's a scholar in Israel called Nadav Schnern, and he says all this stuff about looking at Maros, Hilchos Nida. It's a big problem because people don't see colors the exact same. And you can do, you ever do those things online where you show people something and some people see one thing, others see another? So the whole issue of, looking at a color, if we don't see it the exact same, how can there be a tradition of, not to mention the fact that in many places there wasn't, this is a fairly new thing, of shimush. In earlier years, poskim didn't do this thing they called shimush, where you're supposed to go with a rabbi and he teaches you about the colors. But even if so, if we see him differently, it's, so he has a whole piece on that. It's interesting. Now, one more thing about the talus, and then we will end, I think, because I can do the rest later. Nachash Maya also wrote me about, I said that the Chazon Ish had one student in Vilna. I remembered afterwards that it was also Shlomo Cohen is a student of his, but he reminds me, because he sent me something for someone who wrote a dissertation on Grada, Meir Lieberman, Shaul Lieberman's brother, was a student of the Chazon Ish in Vilna also. One more, so where did the stripes come from? If you look at Danny Sperber in Minhag Yisrael, he says they come from the toga. That in Roman times, Jews wore a toga. And they, which tzitzis, well, they wore something like it, that but which had tzitzis on it. And since the togas we know had stripes, so the Jews did it. This is elaborated on in this article by Zvi Ron, Stripes, Hats, and Fashion. And the stripes, of course, are not found in any Jewish sources. So he has a whole article dealing with this. He quotes what I just mentioned, the Eliyahu Rabbah. He Yarok, he translates this as blue turquoise. So, okay, maybe Yarok also is turquoise, but I wouldn't say blue turquoise, I would say turquoise. Maybe that's, you can translate Yarok, although Ben Yehuda doesn't. And then he says, he speaks about black stripes, but he says there's no, if you look in all the sources, no one explains why there's stripes as opposed to not another. If you want to have a color to remember, why not a circle, a star? Why stripes? And he also follows Sperber, brings some other sources. In ancient Rome, there were different toga styles. The normal toga with one color, the senatorial class, and their togas with the purple stripes, etc. Is this true? I don't know. It seems to be the received wisdom that it's because the toga, I don't know. I can tell you that, I mean, first of all, people didn't wear talluses for davening in the days of the Gemara. This is a medieval thing. People wore garments all the time that had the dalet kanfos. In medieval times, they start wearing a talus, a gadol, because they're not wearing the same sort of garments that have four corners, so they dafka will wear it during davening. Did the people in medieval, I mean, they still continued with it? I mean, the Sephardic world never wore, if it's because of the togas, how come in the Sephardic world they didn't wear, have stripes? And so it carried over into the Ashkenazic world. And then when they stopped wearing, he's telling me that in the 7th, 8th century, if they stopped wearing these garbs, they wore talluses, they wore the stripes. There's no evidence of it. All we have is the example of the togas that they had stripes. And therefore, there's an assumption, well, the Jews must have imitated it. Maybe. It's as good an answer as you can get, but it's not like we actually have any actual source that says this or any real evidence. It's just the fact that we know. We don't even know that in Talmudic days, and we don't even know that in Mishnaic days, Roman days, that the Jews wore this garb. It's just an assumption. So I'm not 100% convinced. Okay, let me take the comments and questions. The rest of the thing, I think we don't need to go over. Let's see, quickly, I'll go through it. Hello, everyone. Glad to have you here again. Paul says that one of his daughters-in-law and his grandchildren direct the Senate to the Baal Shem Mikkelstadt and then of Zelman Bear. Yeah, but not Zelman Bear Bamberger. You go to Mikkelstadt today. It's a place of pilgrimage. On our Germany tours that we did, two of them, we went, because first of all, it's a wonderful little German town. It's like you take a step back into the 19th century, and right there is the famous Baal Shem of Mikkelstadt that Hasidim go to his grave, and it's a big problem because right over his grave, as you look down, is a pool. So here you have the grave, and then you have the pool. It's not so sinuous, so they put up like a big marker there. But it's if we ever get to travel again, we go and we'll do our Germany trip. We'll go there. Did you have a secular education? Yes, I mentioned that. In addition to the establishment of Jewish educational institutions, did Bamberger David says his position entail being in charge of local kashrus? What local kashrus meant was that shochtim, he's in charge of the shochtim. The shochet would have to show his knife, and they would be in charge. Every town had a shochet. That's what it means in those days to be in charge of kashrus. If someone opens up an inn in Würzburg, a kosher inn, then Rabbi Bamberger testifies that this person is a muchsak b'kashrus. If someone opens up an inn in one of these things, he's a muchsak b'kashrus. That's the job of the rabbi. That's the extent of it. They didn't have packaged food items, and you didn't have catering halls like we have today. You have a wedding. One of the Jews in town makes the food and serves it, and he's a muchsak b'kashrus. We've spoken about how they didn't have ashkachas like we have today. Now, someone privately tells me that the Amiral Beis Yaakov, the work for women and girls, was required in the curriculum for girls into the 20th century. You have to tell me, though, required where? In Würzburg, I can understand. Required in other places as well. And, when someone says, I didn't know that.
All the German Hauserhaus schools.
All the German schools?
Throughout the country.
Ah, very nice. Now, you say tonight is Kristallnacht.
Hebrew, sure, you to Zion.
Okay, I just know the English date.
Actually, it's gone to be called a Pogromnacht instead of Kristallnacht, because that's what the Nazis called it in derision. So most people today call it Pogromnacht. Or Zion Machesh, just like any other thing else.
Okay, square from that. As for his biblical Talmudic commentaries, he didn't publish, but we will get to what he has to say about Shaddal. Very interesting. And Howard Naftali, who's an expert on this, is pointing out things for us. Someone calls my attention to the picture. I'm going to show you the picture again here. We see some people here wearing the tallis over their heads. Just one person's over their heads, or two people over their heads. Look, in Germany, only the Rav, maybe, or the Dayanim could do that. And in Eastern Europe, it was common for everyone to wear the tallis. Ituf. You say Ituf.
Ituf Mole was not over the head. It was surrounding the body. You look at all the pictures of the German Rabbanim.
Oh, you mean not over the shoulders?
Didn't wear it over the shoulders. Wore it around.
Over the shoulders, yeah. Okay, I see it's over the shoulders there, not like way we do it. There's different ways of doing it. The Yemenite trap it one way. In terms of Ituf, though, there's an interesting article in Hakira, but it actually, this has been said by many people before. We all grew up, you wrap yourself, everyone does it. You put the tallis over your whole head. Now, it's supposed to be like a Tifas Ishmaelim, the way the Arabs walk. If your whole head is covered, you ever seen an Arab walking that way? You fall in a pit. So really, not that you can change the minhag, it's sort of impossible, but it should be, your face should be open, or at least your eyes should be open when you do this. The way we wrap it around ourselves, Tali, so I ask you, Naftali, have you ever seen anyone in Germany who does not completely cover their head and when they wrap the tefillin, Talis? I can't hear you. Oh.
Say the bracha?
Yeah, well, in other words, for the atifa, to cover your head and cover around, but leave the eyes open, because that's the way the Ishmaelites would walk. Right. And have you ever seen anyone not cover their whole head? Not cover their face? I think everyone does. I think that's a unanimous Ashkenazic minhag. But if you look in the article in Chakira, there were people who protested this and said, how could that be? And you had the sergeant, of course, all said, well, what do you expect Ashkenazim? They don't live among the Arabs. They don't know what an Arab looks like. And they just, but it seems to be one of these things that in the Ashkenazic world we do, and it wasn't, it's really not authentic. Henry Kissinger was born in Firth. Yes, comes from, I'm correct on that, aren't I? No, that's my memory. He comes from an Aguda family. He's still kicking. This might be his swan song. His last thing people remember, he gave an interview 2 weeks ago and said that these European countries made a big mistake. They let in too many foreigners. By foreigners, he means, you know, Africans, Middle Eastern. He says that, you can't assimilate so many people. And hey, when you have 100,000 people marching for Hamas in London last week, we have a problem. Finally, Rabbi Shudno says, Rabbi Faor told you to wear techeilas al pi araiva. There's lots of different ways of doing techeilas, different shitas in the Rishonim. And then Rav Schechter has his own shita, as he adopts, tries to make two. My attitude is, whatever you do, you're right. You know, Sefer Chinuch, the Gra, the Rambam, my tzitzis, which I wear on Shabbos, are Rambam, and my tallis is Sefer Achinuch. Some have one, some have two tchelis. Hold on here, so let me get to... I'm thinking, you're right. Hold on a second. I was. No, it's the. Hold on. Okay, well, I'm talking to Paul. Paul, Zekel Wormser is not the Baal Shem Mikkelstadt. It's right. A different person.
Right. He married the daughter of Yitzhak Zekel Wormser.
Not
Zekel Leib Bremser.
Not the different.
Al Shem Mishnah, but Zekel Leib Bremser.
Yeah. By the way, they published most Mechon Yerushalayim published the Baal Shem Michelstadt's Torah, and it has a biographical introduction by Meir Hildesheimer. He was a tzaddik. I'm one of these like Hasidic type tzaddik in Germany, and you can go see his show. Everything there. And two more things. David, you peruse his tshuvos, and he's a tshuva when you can rely on the kashas of a shochet who engaged in loans with interest. He rules as long as the isser was done by shogeg, you continue to rely on the kashas of a shochet. We're going to go through the tshuvos. I gathered from the various tshuvos of Rabbi Bamberger a selection which I think will interest our listeners. He has a few volumes of tshuvos. And last one, Rabbi Shudnow, according to the Raivad, you see two trailer strings, a full long string. Yeah. I don't know. If Rabbi Fowler was with us, unfortunately he's not, we could ask him why he favors that over the others. And I said finally, I'll move one more finally. Someone privately says that Kissinger's parents were members of Breuers as he was in his youth. So I forget, he was in Firth or Frankfurt, where he was in Firth, right? So what's the Breuer? You mean Breuer's in New York?
He was born in Firth, and then when they moved to Washington Heights, yeah.
Washington Heights, his parents were. But he was, I don't know when he stopped being observant. Obviously, in his youth, but he stopped. In fact, someone told me that there was an event on one of the holidays, and Kissinger was across the street, and he wouldn't even go across because he wanted to be totally separate from, I don't know if he kept any religiosity whatsoever, any Jewish feeling once he left his community. Do you know, Naftali, when he stopped being observant?
No idea.
Yeah. But this is class number one.
Those who knew him in his youth said he was observant as a young man.
Yes, yes. And his parents apparently were tzaddikim.
He's vice president of the Kodesh Yisrael of Germany.
So, okay, you can't judge my parents by how the children turn out. Rabbi Kelman.
The Thomas of my shul, Hinton Adas.
Yes?
Mr. Oppenheimer taught Kissinger of his bar mitzvah, etc.
Ah, that's interesting to know. We missed you yesterday. I hope you're feeling okay, Gershon. I spoke to your daughter and son-in-law at the Tikva conference, and we're going to be together this Shabbos at Princeton. I'm going into the lion's den. I actually was there last Wednesday because they were having a Palestinian rally, and I had to listen to Intifada, you know, which means basically kill Jews, in the middle of Princeton's public square there. So hopefully we'll bring some light to Princeton this Shabbos, bring some light to the darkness, and I look forward to seeing your grandson.
I saw the
Okay, Rabbi Kelman, you with us?
I'm with you. I'm not interrupting. I'm listening.
Okay. So we begin class one with the great Rabbi Bamberger.
Okay.
We have a lot to do. Not 15 classes. I think four or five will. But then we move on to the Mussar movement.
Well, we started.
That's due to a request from our good friend Yaakov Yellen. I'm going to deal with the Mussar dispute. I promised people years ago we do classes on, I did on Hildesheimer, I did on Hirsch, I did on Hoffman. So we have to do Bamberger.
So, yeah, for sure. Okay, listen, the original of when we started this series back in 2008, you know, we were doing 2-3 a person, and then it sort of got longer, 6-7.
I know. You don't want me to do. I did Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, I think, in one class. You don't want me to do it in two classes. Hirsch in one class.
You
give me Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, I'll do 70, 80 classes. But I think we're going to skip that.
We'll get there. I don't know if to do 70. Maybe that's a little much, but whatever.
No, but we got it. We'll return to them. The early Gedolim didn't get a proper portrayal. Remember, we drew a Vod Yosef in one class. Then we went back. We did, I think, three of the early years, three of the middle years.
Then you went back later, middle years, and you did.
And then I didn't do the late years.
You had two classes, and.
But these Gedolim we did Ritzel Chanan properly, like 6 or 7.
Right.
We did the Chasam Sofer, Chaim Ozer.
The Aruch HaShulchan you did properly, right? That was
Them we did properly. So we got to go back maybe to some of the early ones.
That was those were 6-7 classes. I think the Nasi was 8 classes, right? But the early ones were 2 classes, 1 class, 3 classes. Anyway, now we're 15 classes. You know how it Nitgadlu HaDorah, as they say. All right. Listen. we should all be well, and we should hear good news. I agree everything, but what do I have to add? But Rabbi Shulman tomorrow, by the way, not that it really matters now, but I think it's nice, just he did mention the end of the month, really, in 3 weeks. He's going to be missing two classes going on. Please God, a solidarity mission to Israel. You know, lots of rabbis are going now. The RCA has a whole thing. They're sending, I think, every week different rabbis going on solidarity missions. So Rabbi Shulman will be teaching the next 3 weeks, but then he's going on a solidarity mission to Israel. And then, of course, we have our four classes on Wednesday. And listen, David, nice to see you always. I think it's wonderful, all the Israeli people come from Israel, and all the many Israeli teachers we have who are teaching, of course, in our daytime classes. So what can we say? It should be...
I would say, Rabbi Kelman, I think I speak for everyone here who's not in Israel, not all Admas HaKodesh, that, you know, Yimo Anochi Vesara, that we feel the pain, but we also feel guilty. I can tell you right now, I feel guilty.
It's right. It's much
just harder. Like Shaul Lieberman said in the letter I published on the last Feuerbach post, he felt guilty. He wasn't there to throw when this is going on. I mean, how can we not feel guilty? You know, you're going through this. And so that's why it's great that people, YU is sending a group next week. YU is sending a group of students. And hopefully I can go maybe middle of December when I finish the semester. If hopefully it'll be over by then. And
The other thing I pointed out, I've said before, maybe not when you were here, that you see how important Israel is for Jews around the world. It's unbelievable how in 2 weeks anti-Semitism is like, it's just crazy. You know, we always said, you know, Jews can walk around in New York and in Toronto with their heads high only because of the state of Israel. And now it's like really, that's just a little thing we see. But correct, the people in Israel are protecting Jews around the world. And it's the mitzvah of our generation to make Aliyah. I guess most of us here have not fulfilled that mitzvah. But David, how long are you living in Israel? Are you still here? David, I'm just curious, how long are you living in Israel?
I came in 1988 when I was 17 without any intention of remaining. And I've been here ever since. Except for 1 year, YU.
Where'd you grow up?
North Miami Beach, Florida.
North Miami Beach, Florida. So you came without the intention of staying. Yeah, okay. Listen, a lot of my friends have made Aliyah. I've been from my school, from Or Chaim, probably 30%, 25-30%. And even from chat, you know, Paul Shavivas, who was my boss for many years, running the school, the head of school at chat. I think what is it? About 10-12% of chat graduates have made Aliyah, which I think is quite a high figure. During chat's a non-denominational school, really has the entire range of the community, that over 10% of kids have made Aliyah. And I know there are a few kids in the Army now, graduates of chat in recent years. So, you know, what can I say? At least there are people making Aliyah. And anyways, we should hear good news. I don't know, Paul, if you want to add anything, but anyways.
I have to say good night. I have to sign off. It was great again. Great to see you all again. Everybody. And God willing, next week.
Yeah. Okay, everybody. I can sign off. Just Thursday night, Moshe Sokolow will be giving the Parsha Shir. I asked him, most people I send them all, they sign up whatever Parsha, but I specifically asked Dr. Sokolow to teach Parsha Vayera because he wrote an article a number of years ago on how not to teach the Akedah, whole thing on the Akedah. So I thought that it would be good for him to teach the Parsha this week. So Moshe Sokolow, of course, done many, many times for us, will be Thursday night and all our regular Shirim. Okay, we look forward to learning with you, hearing good news. Everybody should be well. Besorot Tovot and Laila Tov, everybody. We look forward to learning with you soon.
Good night.